Welcome back to Insights Now. I'm David Kelly, Chief Global Strategist here at JP Morgan Asset Management. Municipal bonds have struggled so far in 2025 as increased issuance and elevated volatility have weighed on prices. However, with risks of the current economic expansion rising, the case for munis has only grown more compelling. On a tax equivalent basis, muni yields are higher relative to treasuries and compete with those offered by corporate credit. Additionally, the muni yield curve is steeper than other markets, meaning investors are compensated more for extending duration. At the same time, they have less credit risk. Not only do state balance sheets look healthy, but across credit ratings, municipal bond default rates have been consistently lower than those in corporate bonds. All this being said, the sector is not without its challenges. Federal spending cuts, tariffs, and restrictive immigration policies could disrupt activity across municipalities, although these impacts will be felt differently across sectors and regions. In this episode of Insights Now, my new co-host Gabriela Santos will be joined by Nini Jenkins, head of municipal bond research, to discuss Nini's outlook for the sector. If you're listening to the audio version of this podcast, you can now watch along on YouTube by tuning into our JP Morgan Asset Management channel, linked to the show notes. Now let's get started. Over to you, Gabriela.
Thank you so much, David. And thank you so much for being here with us. Let's dive right in. Munis. Hey.
Yes.
What kind of things make municipal bonds unique?
From an investment perspective, one thing that makes it unique to the rest of fixed income is the tax advantage. So investing in municipal bonds on a tax-exempt basis can really provide an advantage and an exemption from federal, depending on where you are in the United States, from state and local taxes as well. So that's a huge benefit of investing in municipal bonds. From a credit perspective, it is a very broad category of credits. There are over 50,000 issuers, that's state, local, various other debt issuing entities, which is quite broad. But when you think about it from an index perspective, only 42% of those issuers are in the index. So there's really a lot of credit opportunity away from the index where some strategies really can't participate as easily. I think the other thing that's really, I think, fun about munis is that the issuers are issuing this debt for infrastructure, and they try to match the debt to the useful life of the assets. So the debt amortizes and sometimes isn't as lumpy as you would experience in the rest of the fixed income market.
That's really interesting. I think people forget that there's a specific use case for that fundraising,
right?
Issuers are doing.
They're not jumping in for liquidity. They're not financing deficits usually, although some very bad actors do that from time to time. Most of the market's pretty high quality, and that's I think really reflective of just broad revenue raising ability and conservative management. So I think that's what's fun about munis: just higher quality, lots of diversity.
I've always thought that you make munis fun, so I've been excited for this. And you mentioned 50,000 different unique issuers, but can you kind of put them in buckets in terms of common drivers and common?
Absolutely. I think the way we approach it, and I think the way that makes a lot of sense, is to group them into three broad categories. The first category I would describe is probably the one that's most familiar to individuals. They're states, local governments, school districts, and I would group that into tax-backed credits. Most of the rest of the issuers are revenue-backed in general. So these are bonds backed by specific projects or organizations in purpose. And within that group, it's bifurcated between more essential revenue, much more monopolistic, and then the discretionary revenue, which is much more enterprise in nature. So some examples there.
Electric
utilities, water utilities, that's the monopolistic essential revenue type of debt. And then on a discretionary side, you might have something like hospitals, where you do need to go to a hospital, but which hospital you go to can introduce a bit of competition.
And is that where higher education fits in?
Higher education is really interesting because it's a sector that it doesn't involve a degree of choice. typically. So we do look at it within the revenue sector. The bonds are typically backed by the revenues of the university.
Of the universities. And how are credit fundamentals looking as we come into this year across these major groups?
Right. Obviously, there's a lot of diversity in our sectors. As a whole, when you look at some of the largest issuers of municipal debt, coming into this year, they are coming in with really strong revenue performance that's provided a good degree of reserves. And that has been moderating more recently. But we think that their management teams are poised to make the right decisions given their conservative nature and really provide some stability in the market. There are two areas where we're seeing a bit more challenges. That would be in the higher ed and healthcare sectors. And we have been for quite some time monitoring some of the challenges in the higher ed sector.
And maybe there's so much going on in munis this year. I'm sure you're very busy. But maybe that's one particular area we could start with, higher education. So how do you see maybe the change in administration, some of the federal uncertainty with regards to universities, for example, affecting the higher ed space?
You know, it's interesting. We spent a lot of time on this sector for a number of years. So before I jump into the federal piece, I just want to start with a level setting.
Please, please, please.
A lot of the challenges in the sector, if you remember, you go back to the pandemic, it's a sector that was uniquely exposed to the very depths of the pandemic. They were shut down. A lot of students had to attend school remotely. And that presented some challenges from an enrollment perspective. Then there was a big change to the FAFSA application, which caused another round of disruptions in the sector. And then finally, we get to where we are now. It's 2025. Our lead higher ed analyst, Doshi, likes to say, you take 2025 and you subtract 17 years and where are you? 2008.
How interesting. Yes.
2008, great financial crisis. It made us all feel poorer and the birth rate starts declining. We are at the peak high school graduation class and we expect it to to shrink 13% from here.
Wow.
And so that's the structural challenge that's underpinning some of the concerns in the sector. And then let's take it back to your question, federal policy. Yeah. So we're dumping on top of the federal, on top of the demographic issue, this federal policy issue, which is really interesting on this sector. There's been so much going on, so I'm gonna
a lot.
there are six broad categories of federal policy intervention that we are monitoring closely. So we'll start at the beginning where it started. As soon as the administration started, it's with federal funding. Federal funding of universities has been introduced. They've been introduced in many kinds. So you have one kind where it's tied to policy outcomes, tied to DEI, tied to various specific policy actions of the universities that seems a bit more targeted. The one that's much broader is addressing research. The National Institute of Health, National Science Foundation, they have what's called indirect costs, and they've introduced the concept of a 15% cap. Now, this is on a sector where that indirect cost was something like 30% negotiated with the federal government, so that's a big drop. And while the cap has been challenged in court and hasn't been imposed yet, that's something we're watching really closely. Overall, research universities are disproportionately impacted by that, particularly policy avenue. In the interim, we've seen lots of universities freeze hiring, layoffs, really change their PhD admissions. This is favorable because they're really balancing the revenue and the expense at the same time.
So from a credit perspective.
From a credit perspective, they're really looking to protect their operations. And so what we see as a red flag would be management inaction on that front. The second piece that I think is really interesting is the international student enrollment, which has been growing quite rapidly more recently. And last month, the U.S. Embassies were instructed to stop scheduling visa interviews. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting time to do that because we're in preparation for fall enrollment.
Yeah.
And so that's a risk that we are really focused on. It's really transient risk. It continues to change over time, but we're monitoring that piece closely. The third piece that's been quite interesting is this introduction of an endowment tax. Now, this would be a tax on university endowment gains, not on the absolute value of the endowment tax. And we've seen a number of policy initiatives and drafts, and we do have a sense of what has passed through Congress so far. But overall, it's very targeted policy because only it would apply to a handful of universities.
That have those huge endowments.
That have huge endowments, correct. And the impact seems to be quite manageable on those particular universities' budgets in and of itself. The other piece that we're seeing... It is really raining federal policy
really
on
is.
The sector, right?
It really is. Grants, international students, potential endowment tax.
Potential endowment tax. So federal policy. Then we have some changes to loans. It's about risk sharing when it comes to loans, an introduction of a cap potentially, and how much of a loan that you can take out, and some consequences to universities if students have trouble repaying them. And that was introduced. And that really is looking to address affordability. And then the last piece is about accreditation of the university. And accreditation is important because you need to be an accredited university in order to qualify for federal loans. And some jobs, there are many employers who require degrees from accredited universities. So being accredited is really important. And so that is just a vast amount of federal policy risk that's been dropped into the sector that we're all working our way through.
Oh, my goodness. I'm sure the whole team is very, very busy identifying the risks, but also maybe opportunities. Do you see any in the higher education, or would you just stay away at the moment?
I think our lead analyst has been amazing, and I would agree that there are opportunities, there are green shoots, and it sounds like a lot, but one, we've had a huge pickup in issuance in the sector that has provided some general widening and provides a degree of an attractive entry point.
I see.
So there is relative value opportunity here. The second is the demographic piece. So while I talked about it broadly, it plays out very differently across the country. There are 12 states that in that environment are projected to see increases in high school populations. And so you have a geography that provide green shoots. Secondly, there are universities, and they're mostly located in the South, that are already operating under the federal policy that are being introduced right now. And we've had conversations with several universities, and they walk us through, well, this is aligned with the way our state operates anyway.
This isn't new to us.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And then lastly, I would say, you know, Doshi has been doing a really great job of stress testing all of these universities, really identifying areas where there's less federal dependence and getting us to a subset of credits that are really favorable and attractive investment opportunities.
And that's our amazing higher ed analyst.
Yes.
Shifting gears to state and local governments.
Yes.
You mentioned coming into this really, really solid in terms of credit fundamentals at an, of course, aggregate level. How are they being or not being affected by changes at the federal level?
That's interesting. Early indications, and I'll level set by saying where the states are and then talk about where the policy risks are in the sector. Early indications are that states who came into this really strong reserves and great revenues, that growth is moderated. We've seen roughly half of the states revised down their revenue forecasts mid-year, which has been very interesting. We have about 46 of the 50 states end their fiscal year at the end of this month. So we're just weeks away from the end of the fiscal year. And it's an interesting time for that moderation to happen because it's making us very watchful over their fiscal 2026 budget process. So they're all finalizing their budgets. And what we're seeing in those budgets are that they're publishing lower revenue forecasts. They're citing fellow policy risks around tariffs, the heightened economic uncertainty. It's made them much more cautious about how they're operating. A lot of these states are really focused on balancing their budget within the means and the environment they anticipate to happen this year. And that's what we would expect in this environment from the states and why they've been so highly rated for an extended period of time.
You would want to see that from a credit perspective.
That being said, we are in uncertain times. And as the environment changes, I would expect to see revisions along the way should things become much more stringent than they expected to really address the economic situation we find ourselves in the actuality.
Yeah.
And they have the flexibility to do that.
So depending on how the economy evolves second half of the year and into the first part of their new or their fiscal year, they can adjust their revenue expectations. Same with federal policy.
Exactly.
I say.
And I think one of the things that I would pay attention to from a more specific expense federal policy exposure is what is going to happen with Medicaid, which is a shared cost between the state and federal governments, and whether they choose to backfill some of these cuts we're seeing for public universities. Or whether they choose to pass down those costs to other sectors, like, for say, with Medicaid to hospitals.
Interesting. So lots happening depending on how these different discussions evolve on Capitol Hill and the White House. And in your day-to-day as an analyst, so of course you're analyzing the credits and just the shifting landscape, but how much are you also talking to specific issuers or specific universities or states or hospitals?
I think in an environment like this, it's absolutely essential. There is one university I think we've spoken to at least once a week or once every 2 weeks,
wow,
given how much is happening in that sector. But also think about it from the state perspective. This environment is one where you really want to understand their strategies, understand their challenges, and why they're making the decisions they're making. And that's been really, really helpful for us as a credit. Like I said, we have lots of different sectors, and this can take on different elements. It may be that, you know, we've got an analyst, David, who's our transportation person. Well, yeah, he's going to fly in and come see the JFK expansion.
That's fun. Well, actually fun for him, not JFK in general.
And really understand the risks and the benefits associated with funding that project. So I find it to be essential. It's sometimes two ways. There's a large major city that I've spoken with, which every time I had a question, whether it was about, you know, consumer pricing values in their tax base or how they're thinking about the assessments of properties within their jurisdiction, I ask a lot of questions. And the last time I was on the phone with the team, she mentions, "Thank you so much for asking me those questions. It changed what I put into my offering statement because now I know that's what investors are interested in hearing about." So I do think that there is a good benefit to continuing to have those conversations and building those relationships. And JP Morgan just has a lot of access.
And definitely different than just reading about these things in the newspaper, especially, of course, these days. In terms of just zooming out the muni market as a whole, when we look at, for example, the muni yield curve, we've really already had been seeing and continue to see quite a steepening. What's going on there? Why are these long end muni yields moving higher? And where to from here, really?
I think first and foremost, our yields are connected to the Treasury curve. We are talking about U.S. municipal credit.
Yes, yes.
But I think then you need to layer in the muni technicals, which are really interesting this year. There's been a big pickup in issuance, a lot of that in revenue sectors, really driving that. Issuance is up 9% over this period last year. And so that's bringing in the technicals from the supply side. On the demand side, it's also quite interesting because flows can drive some of what we're seeing on the curve as well. This year in particular, the flows on the long end haven't been as strong as they had been in prior years. And some of that is really reflective of a bifurcation in our market, with SMAs really participating 10 years and in and seeing much more institutional fund type behavior on the long end, which I think contributes to some of the steepening that we're seeing in the yield curve. And the supply picture continues to remain robust for the end of the year. So,
And for those that are or I guess it's both types, the SMAs or the individuals as well as the institutions, a lot of questions we get, and I wonder your thoughts about, is the tax-exempt nature that we mentioned initially as a unique benefit of munis. Is that going to be taken away? Is it going to be tweaked? Do you think that's going to happen? And then is that already affecting some of these flows that you look at?
We spend a lot of time talking to our colleagues here at JP Morgan who have a really good pulse on Washington. And in our base case is that the tax exemption for the market as a whole remains in place. I think that in the event the tax exemption is challenged, because again, we're in uncertain times, we think it's more likely to focus on certain area of our market. It's described or named legally as private activity bonds, but that is where universities that are private issue debt. That's where we see some hospitals issue debt. And I think you can see within the issuance behavior year to date that the issuers are also concerned about their ability to issue tax exempt debt, and that there might be some issuers who are so nervous that they're coming to market now to really shore up their capital needs for the near term as a result. And so while I don't think that I have a crystal ball that can tell us what happens to the tax exemption, I do think that's the area that's the most vulnerable. And by the way, if that were to occur, it's likely to grandfather existing debt, which makes the debt that has been issued really scarce.
More in demand then.
More in demand than it was before.
So maybe perhaps some tweaks to a certain part of the market. And as you mentioned, a unique feature of munis is that they're issued for infrastructure. And we have so much demand for infrastructure at state and local levels and all kinds of. So makes sense to expect some of the tax exempt nature to continue. And for you, how did you end up actually in this seat? Research? Credit analyst, but also munis.
I early on, when I was very junior, at one point I worked for the City of New York in the Office of Budget and Management. But I also have this very strong quantitative base. I was a math major in college, and I met a mentor. He was great. He just looked at me and he said, "You need to marry your quantitative and qualitative aspects together." And behold, it was muni bonds that seemed to be the right fit for the quantitative and qualitative. And I think you can see through the stress testing that we do on the higher ed side, the quant side is very important, but also understanding policy and how these institutions work that has come together and made me really passionate about munis.
I love it. And I think after this, everyone's going to be much more passionate. And if they are, bonus question for you. What would be a book, a podcast, a movie that you'd recommend for people to get a better understanding of the muni space?
So I would say three things. So I would say I love JP Morgan Markets. I think that it's a great resource and available to a lot of our clients. I think that's a great resource. We have a periodical in our industry called The Bond Buyer, and that's a great source for folks to see information about our market. But my favorite thing to say, and my team hears it all the time, everyone's a muni bond analyst. You vote and pay taxes.
We're all deeply invested in some of these.
We are all deeply invested, whether it's through bonds or another resource, that you're seeing it every day, your tax dollars at work. So
I love it.
We should all be muni bond experts.
We all are, as you've mentioned, whether we know it or not. Thank you so, so much for joining us. And thank you all for listening to another Insights Now podcast. please make sure to check out our broader feed as we've been releasing and will continue to release podcasts with our fabulous fixed income research analysts. And hopefully we'll see you soon. Thank you.
This material is for information purposes only. The views, opinions, and statements of financial market trends that are based on current market conditions are those of the speaker and may differ from those expressed J.P. Morgan Asset Management or by other areas of J.P. Morgan Chase & Co. Any companies referenced are shown for illustrative purposes only and are not intended as a recommendation. We believe the information provided here is reliable, but should not be assumed to be accurate or complete. The views and strategies described may not be suitable for all investors. This content is intended for information only based on assumptions and current market conditions and are subject to change. No warranty of accuracy is given. This content does not contain sufficient information to support investment decisions. It is not to be construed as research, legal, regulatory, tax, accounting, or investment advice. Investments involve risks. Investors should seek professional advice or make an independent evaluation before investing. The value of investments and the income from them may fluctuate, including loss of capital. Past performance and yield are not indicative of current or future results. Forecasts and estimates may or may not come to pass. J.P. Morgan Asset Management is the asset management business of J.P. Morgan Chase & Company and its affiliates worldwide.